It is the 20th anniversary of September 11th, 2001. And to any listeners out there who were impacted by this day, our hearts go out to you. Joining me today is Mark Dunley, and you wrote an op-ed for the Green Education and Legal Fund called The Unlearned Lessons of 9/11, 20 Years Out. You start off by writing that we are less safe than we were 20 years ago. Could you start off by describing what was the USA like in 2001?
Well, the United States was certainly a country with a fair amount of conflict. We'd gone from Carter to Reagan to Clinton and to Bush, so it was moving in a more conservative direction. And we certainly had, as always, had a lot of conflicts in the Middle East. But, you know, 9/11 was so traumatic, and I do really feel for many people who, you know, 20 years later still really have, you know, the grief, you know, from that day. But, you know, one of the really striking things was as we watched, you know, the towers burning at the World Trade Center and then collapsing, it was incredible the loudness of the call by the mainstream media, also with the media, with the politicians of the two parties, to go to war. And, you know, and I remember myself for the Green Party and also Dave McReynolds, a friend of mine, for the War Resisters League. We put out the first calls within about 2 or 3 hours of the towers falling, saying, please, you know, do not turn our grief into a cry for war. It happened to be that this was one moment where the world was really united in sympathy for the United States. And we really could have sort of advanced our own interest if we had prosecuted this as a sort of murder criminal attack it was, you know, rather than using it first to invade Afghanistan to go after the so-called training camps, which allegedly the 9/11 hijackers from Al-Qaeda launched, you know, the attacks. But then, you know, the neoconservative leaders and the Bush administration, particularly Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who had publicly written about the need for another Pearl Harbor, another attack on the United States, in order to provide a pretext for the United States to invade Iraq in particular, in order to seize its oil fields. You know, they used that and lied to the American people, and they lied to the world about so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And it really, you know, turned the United States in a very dark direction, a real curtailment of civil liberties, both here and at home, and got us involved in all these, in these wars. And, you know, a lot of the things that were done, you know, 20 years ago to restrict our civil liberties really have just gotten stronger over the last 20 years. So it's gotten a lot worse, and the country's really divided. And, you know, Bush and Powell started out with the concept, the Orwellian concept, just tell any lie big enough and people will believe it. And then we end up with Donald Trump, who did not seem to have the capacity to tell the truth about anything. And we become so Orwellian in this country and so divided, with half the country having completely different senses of reality.
Like you mentioned, the country was grieving at that time, and there was a lot of kind of social pressure to have a reaction that, you know,
people wanted revenge.
Yeah, they wanted revenge. And so I imagine that there was, what was the community's reaction to your plea for peace? Was it difficult to speak out at this time when a lot of people weren't speaking out in fear of feeling like they were not honoring the grief that was happening at the time?
It was very difficult early on to really rally people to call for peace. We were fortunate that the September 11 Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow, you know, got it, you know, right from the start. And, you know, I had been around, you know, long enough in various peace movements over the decade that I could see, you know, what was going to occur, and how things were going to progress. It did really take a lot of the other peace activists, you know, a couple of months before they were willing to speak up. But at the same time, you know, a year or so later, you know, a million people rallied in the streets of New York City, and I think maybe 5 million nationwide, to oppose, you know, the invasion of Iraq. So the peace movement, you know, did find their voice, you know, within that first year. But, you know, I think it was only Barbara Lee from California mm-hmm. was the only congressperson who voted against the invasion Afghanistan. So it was very tough. And also the corporate media was so amplifying the voices for the call to war. That was really what frightened me most on 9/11, was how just incessant the media was that we were going to go, you know, attack Afghanistan. And for those of us in the peace movement, we said, well, wait a moment, you know, terrorism is not an ideology. Terrorism is a tactic, which we should avoid, obviously. And to be honest, terrorism is used both by the most powerful, namely, you know, state government, national governments, and by the weakest, the people who are being, you know, otherwise assaulted and feeling. But, you know, that's, you know, you don't solve terrorism by engaging in increased military action and killing, you know, so many more civilians. And it was our, you know, belief without much proof that it was, you know, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and that was a legitimate concern. And many of us, well, let's go get those particular individuals. Let's, you know, instead of appointing Henry Kissinger, you know, the policy maven, former Secretary of State, who had run the prior coup on 9/11, where we overthrew and assassinated President Allende of Chile, and that's who President Bush had wanted to appoint. You know, we needed to appoint, you know, Colombo or CSI, you know, to sort of, you know, lead up this investigation. And that, you know, when you engage in these attacks, where obviously a lot of people, civilians, end up being killed, you end up, you know, violence just begets more violence. And it was just sort of very clear to a lot of us that if we treated this as a call for war, it was going to be a dark place, not only for people in the Middle East, but also for, you know, America ourselves. And, you know, pretty much we were proven right, you know, over time. You know, to the million people who, you know, protested in New York City, the New York Times actually editorialized the peace activists were really the second major power in the world, basically the major power after the United States, which, you know, did not approve correct. And, you know, a few years previously, you know, many of us had engaged in the so-called Battle of Seattle against the, you know, the launch of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. But there was sort of this growing movement that corporate globalization, basically a race to the bottom in terms of driving down wages all over the planet in order to increase the profits for, you know, multinationals, particularly based here in the United States, wasn't really creating the type of world that we wanted. And, you know, another world was possible. We could, you know, try to create a world to try to meet the needs of all the inhabitants. And obviously that is utopian, you know, perhaps, but it was also very clear that the present American approach of, you know, basically lets America be the most powerful empire and spend the majority of our discretionary tax dollars on building the military and foster, you know, global economic competition and drive down workers' rights in you know, third world countries, was not producing a better world, you know, for the United States. That, you know, the United States people would be more secure if we weren't trying to dominate other countries, but in fact, we were trying to create, you know, the so-called win-win situations where, you know, America was prospering, but so, you know, weren't as well a lot of these developing countries, particularly in the Middle East and Africa, you know, the global South.
You regularly look at what peaceful protesting does, and you've seen a lot of it, participated in a lot of it. What would you tell someone who is skeptical of the impact of a peaceful protest?
Well, the only thing I know for sure is that violent protest does not succeed. You know, violence just produces more violence. And if you engage in violence, which is what terrorism is, as a response, you know, you end up being, you know, your sort of own worst enemy. And, you know, and I'm also very active in Extinction Rebellion. And, you know, they have done studies that show that if you can get 3.5% of a country's population to engage, particularly in nonviolent civil protests, you know, then you're always successful. And I knew growing up that, you know, the two things, you know, we said Nelson Mandela, after the huge fight over apartheid, and a lot of that was built in the United States around civil disobedience and nonviolence. But if Nelson Mandela can walk out of, you know, a South African prison to become the leader of his nation, and if, you know, the wall in Berlin, you know, can collapse, you know, it is possible for change to occur. But at the same time, of course, you know, it's incredibly, you know, difficult. And in the United States, you know, literally has the least democratic electoral system government of any of the many countries on this planet that profess to be democracy. We're the only one that professes to be democracy that only has, you know, basically two major powers, two major parties. And that makes it so easy, you know, for the corporate interests to dominate it. And like Bush Tweed, you know, used to run Tammany Hall, Center of Corruption in New York State, New York City politics a century ago. I'm happy to have the public, you know, vote to select the winner of the election, as long as I get to select, you know, all the candidates in the election. I think one doesn't know what particular solution is going to produce the type of change that is needed. And, you know, so I have very strong opinions about, you know, how you act in certain situations. I'm also one who believes in many, many different people in a nonviolent manner, pursuing what they think are the best ways to change the planet or change the, you know, the local government or the national government, because you never know, you know, what is going to be successful. But I do think you need to engage and people, and you need to have dialogue, and people need to feel that the changes being proposed, you know, really help them. And, you know, Saul Alinsky, one of the organizing gurus that I follow, Rules for Radicals, you know, one of his rules was, you know, those who, you know, wish to be most radical must themselves appear to be the most reasonable. But, you know, I also say, you know, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. And if you're trying to create a peaceful world, you have to act in a peaceful manner. War is strength, is what Orwell was saying in 1984. And that's the message that both parties, the United States, you know, pursue. Is like, we spend so much money on the military industrial complex in order to become the most dominant military force in the history of the planet. But that's not been a secure path to peace. You know, that was very evident prior to 9/11, and certainly the failure of the American, you know, foreign policy since, you know, 9/11 make it very clear that, you know, it's time to reoriented our spending in the United States, not towards ever increasing powers of the military industrial complex. And I say power, I also mean profits. And the military contractors were the big winner, you know, in Afghanistan, but that we need to divert those funds to, you know, meeting domestic needs, and while also recognizing that we actually have a fairly stiff bill to pay to the rest of the world because of all the exploitation that American multinational and military have done, particularly since World War II.
So where is the U.S. right now? It's been 20 years. And are we any closer to having less military presence in the world?
Absolutely not. Biden was by far the biggest war hawk among the major Democratic candidates, and he won. Even under Trump, the congressional Democrats always voted for more money for the military than what Trump proposed. And I believe just last week, the congressional Democrats voted for more money for the military than President Biden proposed. Dwight Eisenhower, leader of the, you know, Allied forces during World War II, president of the United States for two terms, when he departed, he warned the United States about what he actually called the military-industrial congressional complex, that those alliances of forces would increasingly assert its power and take more and more money. You know, every dollar spent, you know, on a tank is a theft from those who are hungry and who are not housed. And the military spending is so dominant, it's in every congressional district, that even politicians who profess to, you know, be peace candidates, like, say, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, you know, invariably end up voting for more military spending because there are military contractors in their district which provide, you know, living wage jobs to his constituents, and they want more of that.
To bring it back to a little bit more of the local impact of 9/11. So after September 11th, there was an increase in anti-Arab and anti-Muslim, or at least what was perceived to be anti-Muslim, because many Sikh individuals were the victims of terrorist attacks. Targeting certain groups is a common reaction when people need an outlet for rage and anger. How did this play out in the capital region? What did you see happening here?
Well, I think we were fortunate in the Capital District in that generally the sort of anti-Muslim, anti-Arabic influence that we saw in the rest of the country was far less prevalent here in the United States. And I will say, you know, one of the big victims of war is always the truth. And, you know, the 9/11 Commission was largely an exercise to sort of protect the reputations of the intelligence industry, the FBI, the CIA, national security, you know, for failing to adequately, you know, protect the United States against this. And there's a lot of evidence that, you know, there were a lot of warning signals, red flags, even warnings from other allied countries that a terrorist attack, you know, was about to occur or possibly could occur. And our intelligence community, you know, failed to take, you know, action on that. And at best was criminal negligence. But in the Capital District, you know, sort of the big issue was about, I think about 3 years later after 9/11, you know, suddenly we hear Governor Pataki and the Albany Police and the FBI, you know, holding a press conference to announce a major breakup of a terrorist ring here in the Capital District. And within hours, I actually held a press conference in front of the mosque on Central Avenue. We said, this is nonsense. There's no allegation that actually there's any terrorist activity took place. No allegation about missiles or actually existed. This was a complete, you know, sting operation against a pizza store owner in downtown Albany and his imam, who came along in order to witness a transaction, which is sort of the practice, apparently, in Muslims when you're, you know, sort of lending money. And even the mainstream media, the Times Union, Carl Strzok, particularly at the Daily Gazette, immediately said, this is bogus, this is oversold, you know, these people really appear innocent. In a big trial, they were found innocent of 20 of the 30 charges. You know, most of us viewed it as the jury basically agreeing these people, you know, really weren't, certainly were not terrorists, and certainly, really, you know, maybe they didn't cross the T's and dot the I's, but was not a major, you know, terrorist activities. And even though they were found innocent on most of the charges, they ended up with, you know, sort of 15 years in prison. And then the FBI informant in this particular case, who is selling illegal security documents, particularly licenses, ends up being the owner of the limousine that, you know, killed the 20 people in Schoharie, and his son running the company ends up with no jail time, you know, for killing 20 people. But the leader, you know, of the mosque, you know, on Central Avenue where the imam was sent away, still said he always felt, and their community always felt, a lot of support here in the Capital District. that civic leaders, political leaders, community groups went out of the way to say, you cannot blame all Muslims for the individual acts of a few individuals. And there were a lot of groups, both in Albany and particularly in Bethlehem, that really rallied to show support for the Muslim community, and also a lot of religious leaders, interfaith leaders. And so that was, much better here in the Capital District, the big exception being the state capitol, where you had Governor Pataki and the state legislators. But the political figures in the Capital District did not engage in that, anti-Muslim rhetoric, fortunately.
Before I let you go, have we learned any lessons from the tragedy of September 11th?
I have not heard many lessons being repeated as we get up, to the 20th anniversary. There still really has not been a call, that it's time to end the war on terror. There's not been any political switch from the major parties that, we should be trying to, increase our humanitarian, relationships. We never dealt with the fact, we just 20 years out, once again, Afghanistan was the graveyard of empires. We left in disgrace. 170,000 Afghans have died because of the invasion, and, several thousand American, soldiers also died. We never addressed the fact, why is Afghanistan in this situation? And Afghanistan is certainly a complicated country, but the reality is that starting under President Carter, the United States invested money and military support to overthrow the government of Afghanistan because they, one, viewed it as being too aligned with the Soviet Union, who was their northern neighbor. But they consciously thought if they could create, a civil collapse, government collapse in Afghanistan by financing these warlords, that it would force the Soviet Union to invade and basically drag him into their own version of Vietnam. And that occurred, their thing collapsed. The Taliban was something that probably the CIA, along with Pakistan, helped put into power to try to destabilize the situation. The Taliban invited in al-Qaeda partly to provide them with security against the warlords. And then allegedly, it was these al-Qaeda training camps that launched the attacks on 9/11. And the CIA itself, which basically had the same thing 20 years previously when it overthrew the government, elected government of Iran, calls this blowback. That when you do, these underhanded things to overthrow governments, it tends to come back in your face with, violence and, terror attacks 15, 20 years later. And we just seem to sort of keep repeating this. And the reality is that we have escalated our war, Cold War with Russia. We particularly started under Obama, really escalated the tensions with China. Certainly, we continue to have a lot of tensions under all presidents, particularly Trump, with Iran. And we continue to meddle into the operations of governments in South America. Still the Monroe Doctrine, exists. And we think it's perfectly fine for us to interfere with Venezuela or Bolivia or Guatemala, Honduras, Haiti, or Cuba. And so we keep on repeating the same mistakes. We've lost a lot of credibility on the world stage. Certainly the chaotic nature of Biden's retreat, which I supported, actually, time to pull the troops out of Afghanistan, but not handled particularly well. But, they said, oh, my God, I thought we were getting better leadership from America after Trump, and now Biden shows not to be able to handle, this type of situation. I think American prestige is at its lowest level ever. Polls show that the rest of the planet views the United States as the greatest threat to democracy in their own country, and that we continue to, export arms to militias all across the planet, either directly or in the case of Afghanistan. We give them to allies who then either turn them over on the black market or they get stolen and end up funding the militias in Africa and the Middle East and, you know, South America. We're the arms merchant of the planet. We have a terrible democracy. And because we send so much money on the military, we don't meet basic needs like housing and health care and education. It's incredible we spend more money on our healthcare system compared to pretty much any other industrial nation in the world, often twice as much. And yet we're consistently ranked among not even in the top 30 in the quality of our healthcare system. And that's all directly attributed to the fact that we spend so much of our resources on the military. And 20 years later, nothing has changed, unfortunately.
Thank you for joining me, Mark Dunley. Your op-ed, The Unlearned Lessons of 9/11, 20 Years Out, is on Green Education and Legal Fund. The website is gelfny.org.
Well, thank you very much, Sina, for, you know, covering this. And I do want to express my condolences to so many, you know, people who, you know, lost their loved ones on 9/11. And, you know, it was terrible. We lost almost 3,000 people at the World Trade Center. But in the early hours, the media was speculating that we had lost possibly 50,000, you know, people. And each of those 3,000 people who died, you know, is heart-wrenching for their families and for their loved ones. And, you know, so sad. And so many people, you know, unfortunately still experience that type of grief in so many other situations on our planet. We need to end it. Peace is the way.
And we should add that people are still dying from the aftermath of the air quality.
Yes, you know, down in 9/11, you know, in fact, a recent report said that I think there were 15,000 people who have filed with the government, you know, that they were first responders at the World Trade Center, and 75% of them have long-term illnesses related to, you know, the collapse of the World Trade Center. And of course, you know, right afterwards, Christine Whitman, head of the EPA, former governor of New Jersey, told people, don't worry about it. You know, the emissions are safe. The air quality is safe. You know, all they were concerned about was, you know, getting the world, the economy back operating. They weren't concerned about protecting the health of the people who lived there, and certainly not concerned about, you know, protecting the health of the first responders. And you know, we failed the hundreds of first responders who died on 9/11. And we failed the tens of thousands of first responders who died because or have become ill because they were first responders.